Monster Man, Episode 153, Anis to Askamoid. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the A section of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. But before we do that, it's time to thank some new Patreon supporters. Yes, these are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like today's patrons, you pledge at the $5 level, you will not only get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I do for the Deities and Demigods book what I've been doing for the monster books, but also you'll be able to choose a monster for a special extra long episode. So thank you very much to both Luke Slater and Neil McClellan. Your support means a lot to me. Listener mail's been piling up, and I do want to take the time to answer it, but I think it might not fit into this episode. I just want to acknowledge one thing. Multiple people have sent me messages telling me that the Banth, which I mentioned in one of the Fiend Folio Inspiration episodes, is, of course, from the work of Edgar Rice Burroughs. It's one of the creatures that lives in the world of Barsoom. And in fact, I think I did know that, but I didn't recognize it in the description, the admittedly pretty brief description, in that issue of White Dwarf. So thanks very much, everyone who pointed that out. I'm sure we're going to get more of these fictional inspirations that I missed, so do keep them coming if that happens. All right, let's look at some monsters. The next monster in this section is the Anis. Now, the Anis is a weird thing to say. The Anis is basically a souped-up hag. It's like a hag, but tougher in a couple of ways. And it resembles a night hag as well, being just kind of bigger and stronger with iron-like claws and teeth. Now, the Anis is based on just Anis. Black Anis, also called Black Anna, or Annie, or Agnes, anything like that. And that is a folkloric monster from Leicestershire in England. And I probably don't even have to tell you that Black Anis is a mean old monster lady who lives in a cave, and she comes out at night to catch naughty children who are out instead of at home in bed where they should be, and also eats up people's lambs. In some versions of the story, she skins both the people and the lambs and wears their skins as clothing, and in other versions she can turn into a cat or has a cat. But basically, she's an evil witchetty hag monster that, you know, a parent might threaten an unruly child with. I feel like this is definitely one of those monsters that suffers from being generalized, and I think that's true of hags in general. You know, even when you have hag as a type, or Anis as a type, in game, I think they should always be individualized, not, who's this person? A hag. Be like, oh yeah, you know, that's Granny Green. She lives in the woods and, you know, they say that she had a curse put on her by the fairies and now she eats children and whatever, right? Like, this should always be individual. You never want to wind up in the situation of going like, ugh, hags again, like you might with goblins. Is part and parcel of the goblin aesthetic that they're wearying, that they're numberless, that they're a problem. But horror monsters, and particularly kind of named individual horror monsters like Black Anis, really sort of work better, I feel, if they're specific people. And we're only four monsters in, but I do wonder if we're going to be seeing more monsters like Anis, who is essentially a bit of an upgrade on the existing Night Hag. She's got better AC than a Night Hag, does more damage, has more attacks, and she's got some good resistances too. So yeah, she's a buffer Night Hag. She's fine. You know, if you want to create a creepy old lady who lives in the woods, and you want to make her a mechanical challenge for a tougher party than would normally be confronted by a Night Hag, then you give him Anis. Fair enough. Next up, we have the Antlion, another of the many D&D monsters created by just taking a perfectly normal animal and upgrading it to a larger size. Now, this is a big version of the antlion, and antlions are actually fascinating. I did not know that the antlion is a larval stage of another insect. It's a larval stage of what is sometimes in the U.S. known as a doodlebug, or a type of damselfly, I think. Anyway, antlions kind of dig pits in sand, and they wait for creatures to come, and they slide down into the pits, and the antlions eat them up. One of the interesting things about the antlion is that this kind of, like, trap predation is a very risky nutritional strategy. You don't know how long it's going to be until something comes along, and when that thing comes along, you don't know whether you're going to catch it, although probably you are, and you don't know how many calories you're going to get out of it. So as a result, antlions have a very slow metabolic rate. They can go for a long period without food. So sometimes in dungeons, you have this problem where you're like, well, okay, this place is supposed to have been abandoned for oh so many years. It can't just be full of kobolds and whatever, but it would make sense for something like an antlion to be there because, you know, even if there's nothing for it to prey on, it could just have gone into a kind of almost hibernating state to conserve its calories. I note that I am presenting a grossly oversimplified version of the antlion's life cycle and metabolism. I'm sure I'm getting it all wrong. All I did was glance at Wikipedia. But the nice thing is that that's all you really need to do for the ecology of a monster. This is not a biology homework assignment. We need a little more animal information than would serve to create an alien in original series Star Trek. So, not very much. It just needs a premise. So there's a great value to fun animal facts as the basis for a D&D monster, even if those fun animal facts are actually kind of misleading. Finally, we have the ascomoid. This is kind of a rolling puffball mushroom. It's just a big ball that trundles along slowly, and if it's threatened, it can puff out a cloud of spores, and the spores can mess you up pretty badly, actually. So the spores kill you unless you make your save, in which case they merely blind and disorient you. So they're pretty bad. Ascomoids are definitely to be avoided. And they're pretty robust, with AC3 and 6 hit dice plus 6. So you're probably not going to just knock them out in one go. Furthermore, they have a lot of resistances, so you can't even chuck a fireball at them and necessarily assume that you're going to kill a whole bunch of ascomoids bouncing down the corridor toward you. The only real thing to do is get out of the way. So you can see how this large trundling ball type of creature would be a terrible threat in the traditional dungeon corridor. I like to think that there is some creature in the dungeon that is immune to the ascomoid spores, or at least has figured out the cure to the ascomoid spores, right? So they're all in their gas masks, or they've rubbed a special salve under their noses, or whatever it is. And the goblins have got, you know, a bunch of ascomoids all penned up behind a gate somewhere in the dungeon. And when they hear someone coming, they're not going to go out and fight them by themselves. They just open the gate and let the ascomoids naturally, you know, trundle down the slope into the corridor, and then once they're safely down at the end of the way, they come out and finish off the survivors who, remember, are blinded and disoriented by all these ascomoid spores. It seems like a suitably goblin-y thing to do, and the sort of thing they might get away with. And particularly for creatures that are immune to poison, right? So undead could do this, for example. Can you even imagine them intentionally cultivating ascomoids and having some kind of horrid fungus field grown from the rotting corpses of their victims? Although that feels a little more goblin-y, although I may in turn just be saying that because of recent releases from Games Workshop, which have got me thinking about goblins and mushrooms together. Alternatively, some kind of natural predator or scavenger might be immune to ascomoid spores and just follow in their wake to gobble up all the things that they leave dead at the ground. I think ascomoids are fun. I think particularly they're fun if you include something like the creature that's immune to them so that the PCs can start to figure out how they might resist poisoning from the ascomoid. Yeah, I think ascomoids are actually a lot of fun. Quite lethal, so you better hope that your cleric isn't one of the ones that fails their save. But other than that, yeah, I think they're a lot of fun. Okay, that's about all the monsters that we have time for today. Be sure to join me next time as we talk about the Aspis and the Atomy on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.